And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like we do every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We have a great show for you tonight, and our guest is the Chief MUFON Video Photo Analyst. His name is Mark D'Antonio. He was on talking about astronomy a while back. Should be a great show. Now, you may be saying to yourself, gee, I thought Noe Torres and his co-author, Ruben, were going to be on this evening. Well, I have to tell you, I made a big boo-boo, and I thought he was in a different time zone. So both Noe and Ruben had a commitment at our show time. And, you know, it really takes a big man to admit he screwed up, so I'm just going to have to deny the whole thing. Anyway, I was able to get our future guest, Mark D'Antonio. Or maybe he already was our guest in the future, and he's traveled back in time. It all has to do with dark matter, and we're going to be talking about that with Andy Fleming in a clip coming up later. You know, I'm wondering why recently a listener wrote me, and he says, you know, he doesn't get my weird sense of humor. But he also said this was his favorite show. I think they call that a backhanded compliment or something like that. Whatever it is, I'll take it. So in the news recently, billionaire, entrepreneur, and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk let the curtain to the future drop on Thursday on May 29th to reveal his company's new manned Dragon version number 2. And this is going to be an astronaut transporter. I believe it will take, I think it is 7 astronauts to the International Space Station. And right now the Russians have they're charging, I believe it is $17 million per seat to get us to the space station and back. So Elon plans to keep it in the U.S., and who knows what's going to happen in the future with the Russians bringing us there anyway. So I have a little clip here of Elon talking about it right here.
There are a lot of interesting technologies in version 1. It does have a relatively conventional landing approach. So it throws out parachutes to land in the water after it comes back from the space station. And it does have a life support system, but not one that can last for a long time or carry a lot of people. And so it's a great spacecraft, and it was a great proof of concept. It showed us what it took to bring something back from orbit, which is a very difficult thing to do. And usually when something comes in from orbital velocity, it burns up in a big fireball. But going from Dragon version 1, we wanted to take a big step in technology, really create something that was a step change in spacecraft technology. And some important characteristics of that are the ability to land anywhere on land propulsively. So that's one of the things that Dragon version 2 will be able to do. So you'll be able to land anywhere on Earth with the accuracy of a helicopter, which is, I think, something that a modern spaceship should be able to do. And it'll be capable of carrying 7 people, 7 astronauts, for several days. It has an improved version of our Pika heat shield, and it's all around really a big leap forward in technology. It really takes things to the next level.
Now, if you look at pictures, we have one on our homepage, podcastufo.com. All of the pictures of the crafts and everything that are shown are always like squeaky clean and white. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Musk's, or is it Musk? Anyway, however you say it, big fan of his, and join our chat room. Coming up right now, we have Andy Fleming, and he's going to talk about dark matter.
Hi, Martin, and listeners. Now, it's an embarrassment of gargantuan proportions that lies at the heart of modern physics, a kind of cosmic elephant in the room, if you will. Put simply, physicists realise that when we look out 13.7 billion light-years across the visible universe with our telescopes, whether at visible, infrared, gamma-ray or X-ray wavelengths, we're only seeing a tiny proportion of all that there is. Modern physics and its key theories of quantum mechanics and general relativity, which have successfully provided us with everything from iPods to GPS systems, simply doesn't have a clue as to what makes up 96% of our universe. The best estimates of cosmologists and physicists reveal that only 4% of the universe is constituted of normal baryonic matter, consisting of the things we see with our eyes and detectors. This is made up of atoms and their constituent parts, and includes stars, planets, and intergalactic dust. Einstein said that mass and energy are equivalent, and since the late 1990s, astronomers and cosmologists have found that a staggering 73% of the universe is made of something called dark energy, which reveals itself by an anti-gravitational force. It turns out that the expanding universe, as first revealed by Edwin Hubble, isn't just expanding at a linear rate. The expansion is actually accelerating. One day in the far and distant future, cosmologists will no longer see galaxies outside our own cluster. They'll simply be over the cosmic horizon, too far away for light to have had enough time to travel to the Earth. For now, though, we have little idea as to what dark energy actually is. We may have rather more success in identifying dark matter, first postulated by astronomer Fritz Zwicky in 1934, to account for the missing mass needed to sustain the orbital velocities of galaxies in clusters. Subsequently, other observations have indicated the presence of dark matter in the universe, including the gravitational lensing of background objects by galaxy clusters, such as the Bullitt cluster, and the temperature distribution of hot gas in galaxies and clusters of galaxies. It is believed that most dark matter, by its very nature, does not consist of atoms. It doesn't interact with electromagnetic radiation, and therefore we cannot detect it with our telescopes. There are many speculative possibilities as to what dark matter may be, including a whole zoo of standard model or exotic particles, including neutrinos and supersymmetrical particles, brown dwarfs, rock, dust, or black holes. Whatever dark matter turns out to be, and there are many experiments being conducted around the globe to detect it, including at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN and in the Zeppelin III dark matter detectors at Cleveland Potash's mine at Boulby, Whitby in the United Kingdom, we are likely to have an answer as to what this fundamental constituent of the universe is long before that for dark energy. Whichever way you look at it, it's an embarrassment, though, for modern physics to only know what just 4% of the universe is actually made of.
That's right. Please join in our chat room at podcastufo.com and chime in our guests, ask our guests some questions, or do your regular interacting, bickering, or whatever it is you like to do. And we have Mark D'Antonio on the line. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much, you know, for jumping in at the last minute. I really, really appreciate it. And, you know, you were going to be a future guest, but I just really want to thank you for coming on tonight.
Oh, not at all. Like Andy was just saying, you know, that we use dark matter here all the time. It's rather boring now. But we use the technology to kind of jump back and forth through time. It's, you know, it's little stuff. So not a big deal to come back and do your show weeks after I had already not done it, but then come back. Oh, I just changed the timeline. Uh-oh. Oh, boy.
Oh, no. This is just way too much for my head. Yeah.
This is a problem. My dog has 5 heads. Uh-oh.
And that's just the beginning. Don't look around.
I shouldn't have stepped on that butterfly. I knew it.
I do remember your sense of humor. We recorded about astronomy, I think it was about a year ago or last fall, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We had Yeah, that's correct. That was a lot of fun. So you are, I have a number of things I was thinking of to ask you. You are the chief video and photo analyst, am I saying that right, of MUFON?
Yeah, the chief photo and video analyst for the Mutual UFO Network. And what that really means is that I'm someone that was perfectly happy to do it. No, I'm kidding, of course. It was something, I've actually been a member of MUFON since 1971.
Wow.
Yeah, I was 11 when I joined MUFON. I'm not kidding.
I'm not kidding.
I am not. That's actually true. I mean, and everything I say is true. It's just a little jest thrown in here and
this
there.
This has nothing to do with time travel again, though.
No. Okay. I knew I was going to regret saying that. Yeah. But I was 11. I had just I had been out of the hospital after having a surgical procedure done, and my parents
brain surgery.
Actually, that was 18 years ago, but that's a different story.
Not at all.
I, if you can't laugh at yourself, you can't laugh, right?
Okay.
So, no, but it was, interesting because I had always been interested in UFOs, and I would go outside, look up, see the gorgeous night sky, and the first thing I wanted to do was take a picture of it. And, of course, back then when I was 11, okay, it was, kind of tough to get a film that could actually – do the job, number one. Number two, it was tough to get a camera, in general, as an 11-year-old, who's going to go out and have the money to get a wonderful camera? So I didn't get any of those things, but what I did get was a telescope. And the telescope was given to me by a dear friend of the family. And I have to tell you, that and one other interaction I had with someone at NASA got me fully into astronomy. So I would look outside with the telescope all the time, and then that sparked my imagination to create a space station plan and send it to NASA. And I did just that on notebook paper with the lines, and where I tore it out of the little, notebook binder. And I sent it to NASA, and it was looked at by a man named Bert Lee. Now, most people know him as Gentry Lee. Gentry Lee is the runs the directorate for the Outer Solar System robotic missions. And he was a young scientist at the time at NASA. He looked at my space station plan, and instead of just dismissing it and laughing at it with his colleagues or whatever, he actually returned it to me with all kinds of wonderful handwritten suggestions on each and every page. And then he put it in what I called my space box, a gigantic box, to me anyway. Right. A gigantic box to this 11-year-old kid that was full of cloth mission patches for all of the, human space flight and books and brochures. I mean, he filled that thing to the brim. And I have to say, it was very, very, incredible for me. And literally about a year and a half ago, after not communicating with him since that point, I wrote him an email. And he responded and said, "I don't remember the incident, but boy, this is great. Let's keep talking." So it was really cool to actually reconnect with Gentry Lee, one of the people that I idolize in our human spaceflight endeavors.
Wow, that is just amazing. That really is something. And then you are actually now, I'm sorry, it's been several months. You're actually an astronomer?
Yeah, that's what I got my degree in. I went to school for that. I spent many a year in freezing cold observatories where the telescopes are so big that the entire floor moves up and down to meet the telescope, as it's moving around the sky. And that was when we had to work right at the eyepiece. I was taking photos on glass plates because film wouldn't do. The reason is it was part of a study called the parallax study, which what parallax is, of course, is the effect you see if you hold your finger out at arm's length and you hold up your index finger and you blink left and right with your eye. You're seeing the parallax effect. You can actually see that the background remains relatively in the same position, but the finger is shifting dramatically back and forth in the foreground. Well, in the same way, when we look at foreground stars that are not too far away from us, we would see at each end of Earth's orbit, not the left and right eye, but the both ends of the Earth's orbit, we would actually see that star shifting against the background stars. And this gives us its distance to an extremely precise degree within a certain distance. You know, beyond beyond that, of course, we can't use parallax. We have to use other, you know, techniques. So there's it goes on and on. But that was the program that I was involved in for a number of years. And the glass plates would record a very precise image. And then those plates would be used with a machine from Yale University, which would actually scan the density of the star image on this film emulsion. Can you imagine that? Film. Who's heard of film? There's a lot of people out there that have never owned a film camera now, you know?
I know.
And so we would, you know, do that. But, you know, and so it was interesting to go through that process. And then, you know, using similar research telescopes, I did my thesis, which was on finding stars that are speeding out of the galaxy at high speed through gravitational interactions. And I found a few, which is great. Yeehaw! Wow! My claim to fame. And I found some fast-moving star.
Now, getting back to our topic this evening.
Sure.
I would like to talk to you about, you know, some of the, I guess, some of the more interesting UFO videos and pictures that you have researched. And I guess what I'd like to know is what stands out to you as some of the most interesting ones that you've dealt with?
Well, one of the things about UFO photos is, first of all, we have to find out what it's not. So when I see a UFO photo or a video, the first thing I do is I look at each and every one from the same set of processes, okay, that are running through my head. First, I try to explain it away. Now, at first, that sounds like I'm being a debunker. Actually, it's far from it. I'm trying to eliminate variables, and I have to eliminate those because someone else who might be doing independent research might find something in the image that I missed. So I can't afford to really miss anything. I have to really take the time to do the diligence to actually look through these images and say, okay, if I'm thinking that this is something that's in the foreground in this image, I need something to back that up, not just an opinion, but some science. And that's the thing that I tend to do, is I tend to use science to help us explain what we're seeing in an image, because sometimes you capture an ordinary object in a most extraordinary way, and that's the thing that can throw people off. And there's a lot of – you're fighting psychology, because there's some psychology of how we observe the world that cameras don't know. And so when we take a picture of, say, birds flying through a frame, we ignore them while we're taking the picture because they're just birds.
Right.
Okay. But the camera, of course, captures these really interesting dark dashes flying along the horizon. What's that? You know, you don't know what that is. And that's the thing that we're trying to, you know, we have to explain, again, using science. So we have to talk about how are birds shaped when they're caught in an exposure. Sometimes you don't see them crisp and clear. They're blurry. But the blur gives you lots of data. There's interesting things you can deduce from that blur. And there are shapes, for instance, of a bird that looks just like, a UFO of some kind, except if you then look at the exact outline that the object, if we don't know it's a bird yet, if the object has on the image or in the video, you can many times see clues that will help you decide what you're looking at. And I know I haven't talked about interesting UFOs yet, but I'm getting there. Okay.
We're getting some questions popping in on our message board. And I want to apologize for our live listeners. I hate to say, but there seems to be some type of studio audio problem. The audio is going in and out. I can tell you right now, Keith Rowland, the producer of the show, is working on that, and they're actually asking. I tried to actually message you, Mark, but they're asking if your mic can be turned down a little bit. It can't really be turned down, but maybe you can pull it away just a little bit. And the question that came up, let's see, they're coming in pretty fast here. Are you familiar with any advanced photography, videography methods such as studying infrared or near ultraviolet?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the things that we're doing right now is we do a lot of work with drones, but people call them drones. And of course, when you call them drones, immediately you think you know, hellfire missiles and killing, killing, killing. Not at all. These are search and rescue systems. These are actually these are systems for use in scanning remote areas. So one of the things that we're developing is an infrared system, as a matter of fact, that will allow us to do remote scans from a long, long way away. And when I say long, long way, I don't mean a continent away. I mean, you know, 10 miles away, you know, because, you know, in a case where you want to, in a case where you want to locate or do a scan of an area, you know, anything within a few miles might be alerted to your presence. So we would rather have a system that can kind of get way up in the air, kind of come in rather unannounced, do some scans, and then leave before being detected. And even if it is detected, it may not be registered as a threat because it's so small. So these kinds of things are very important to us. Now, I told you off the air earlier that we're working with a guy that a lot of people out there know. His name is Doug Trumbull. Doug is an Academy Award-winning special effects legend and a producer. And I've been working with Doug for about 5 years now, I think. It's going on. It's been so long. It's amazing how long it's been. Time flies. And we're actually developing with Doug, in fact, it was Doug's original idea, a system that will actually do autonomous detection of anomalies. Now, we, you know, everyone's heard of SkyWatch systems, and there are SkyWatch systems out there. They're great. But the problem we have is what I see throughout the UFO world, which is replete with photos that are that singular fuzzy photo, but then the witness says, but it was darting across the sky, and then it did this, and then it winked at me. I mean, but then you just see this blurry little dash of light in the sky. So the data doesn't match the witness testimony. So what we want to do is, to your question, use multiple instruments in a SkyWatch system that will actually be able to monitor the sky in a variety of wavelengths, including infrared, ultraviolet, and some other radiation emission elements in the spectrum. You know, we want to look for certain types of particle interactions known to particle accelerator physicists, because those indicate something to us, somewhat of a smoking gun if advanced propulsion technologies are being used. Eventually when string theory and M theory, you know, can be made understandable to people, I think it'll become clearer that we're on a sort of a precipice here. We have to step off with a leap of faith and say, look, our standard physics model that we currently hold dear, which Andy was talking about earlier, right? When he was talking about dark matter, we try to pigeonhole into our standard model what dark matter is. But it's hard because a lot of things don't work. They don't work right within the standard theory. But if we work forward here from this point forward, we're actually on a precipice where we have to take a leap of faith and say, is string theory correct? If it is, then we're going to have to use different types of instrumentation, different types of wavelengths, and different types of setups to look for beings that might be using advanced systems in order to get here. Because, you know, I do this marvelous, funny toilet paper roll analogy when I do talks around the country, and it's the entire history of the Earth on a giant roll of toilet paper. And, you know, the very beginning sheet is 4.6 billion years ago. And then at the very other end of the sheet, 117 plus feet later, is us, you know, on that last sheet. But where we are on that last sheet is in a line that's only 0.01 millimeter in thickness. And that's from ancient Sumer all the way to present day. So just all of the extent of human history is consolidated only in a tiny little line that's thinner than any implement on Earth can draw on the finest paper. So that said, we already see on our horizons, we see techniques to get to the nearest stars in a few days. We can't do it now. We need lots of energy to do this. But we see that possibility. Yes, there's questions. We don't know what to do. How do you make a warp bubble? We don't know. But we do know that theoretically it's possible. That's new because it's never been theoretical before. And some of it hinges on string theory. And then beyond that horizon, there's one more horizon which shows a possibility for us to actually leave our dimensional space. Sounds like we're going down the science fiction road here. But you know what? It's not so much science fiction anymore, right? If we can show the validity of string theory and some of the other ways in which we can supplement or replace the standard model that we use now. So in those farther horizons, we might be able to navigate different points in the universe, you know, in minutes. And, you know, this is something that is really groundbreaking, but in our tiny little thin line of existence in that entire toilet paper roll and a universe that's been in existence a little bit less than three times that, there's certainly other civilizations that probably came along, say, 1 inch before us on that last sheet, which corresponds to several million years. And they would have already seen those horizons we see now in our 0.01 millimeter of thickness of existence and gone past them. So the likelihood that another species, another set of beings could have found us is actually quite high, considering that we see planets that are forming now, and we see planets that have survived the death of their star. So planetary formation has been ongoing from just slightly after the beginning of the universe until now.
You know, listening to another astronomer speak, he mentioned something I thought kind of goes along with this when you're talking about such a tiny little spot of time that we've been here. You know, by the time the sun starts swelling up and, you know, near the end of its existence, the beings that will be on Earth will be as close to us as we were to bacteria. In other words, we'll be so different, whoever is on this Earth in, you know, almost 6 billion years from now will most likely not be us.
Well, yeah.
Just the way, if you look at history, really, you know, the extinctions and, you know, what is it, 99% of everything has gone extinct?
There has been actually in our history on Earth, we've actually had a number of incredible extinctions, which are really, most people don't even know about because they don't really think about it too much. But, you know, everybody knows the KT boundary extinction, you know, the Cretaceous Paleogene, you know, 65 million years ago when dinosaurs died. Everybody knows that, all right? What they don't know is all the other mass extinctions that occurred on this planet. You know, there have been, five or six of them, actually. You know, and if you look at, you know, way back when, you know, we had extinctions from, in the Ordovician era, which was best known for, you know, trilobites and those things. Okay. You know, there was a mass extinction there. 60% of all marine life died then. Amazing, you know. And then, moving forward, there was a number of other, you know, extinctions, you know, for instance, you know, the Devonian extinction, the Permian Triassic border. I mean, we're going back obviously to the eras that are, half a billion years ago, you know, and then so it just goes on and on, you know, we had the Permian extinction, Triassic, you know, which, and of course the Cretaceous extinction that we just talked about. That's the one that people seem to understand, know the most. But Earth has been periodically hit by large objects from out in space, and they have wiped out huge amounts of life on this planet, you know. And I say one of the things I write about in the book is I talk about how had the dinosaurs not become extinct, what would have happened? Would they have developed more cranial capacity? Would they have developed the ability? Well, there's actually a theory that talks about certain raptors that might have actually developed a larger cranial capacity because it looked like when they were extincted that they were actually growing larger brains at the time. So perhaps that was a non-dead end in the path that could have gone to a more intelligent species. So, you know, you would have said, you know, today, he would have said, well, welcome our guest, Mark, to the show. You know, so, Mark, how are those scales and how are the yellow eyes? Ah, doing great, doing great. You know, I mean, we would have had a, you know, a different type of conversation for sure. So what you say is, would life be the same elsewhere? Probably not. And would we even look the same a million years from now? Certainly not. You know, I mean, just from the 1700s, we've grown in height. If you've ever been on a sailing ship, you know, based on the size of the bunks and the ceilings, you can tell that you would have been a very tall man back then.
That's right. Yeah. Let's see. There's someone wanted you to elaborate a little bit on, and I do want to apologize again to our live listeners. Just keep in mind, you can always listen to the podcast. It's very clear on this end. There is some audio issues, so I do apologize. If you wanted to, still wanted to jump in to the chat room, you can at podcastufo.com. And people are saying it's working fine now, but we'll see. So one of the questions is how does string theory play into all this, as far as you're concerned?
Well, when we look into string theory, there's things that within string theory, and I say this in the best possible generic explanation, because otherwise it quickly gets rather obtuse, you know, but because string theory is anything but intuitive. But if you look further into the concepts behind string theory, one of the things that we would be looking for is a way to exploit other dimensionality to space. Now, if you think about it, here on Earth and in our universe, we know what light is. We can generate it. We can reflect it. We can work with it. We know that it is both a wave nature and particle nature. We understand electricity. We understand magnetism. We can generate magnetic fields. We can modify magnetic fields. We can generate electricity. We can modify electricity. But what's the one force that we use every day, that our life depends on, that the sun is stable because of, that we don't know anything about other than how to calculate its value? That's gravity.
That's
so
right. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we can use string theory for, and other corollaries to string theory, and again, this is very generic, is we would have a better understanding of what gravity is. Because if you look at how the universe was created, the theory of the Big Bang, where the primordial superatom exploded outward, right? Well, if you had a balloon that was inflating, then every point on the surface of that balloon would be pulling at every other point on the surface of the balloon. It wants to collapse by its nature, correct? Well, in the same way, gravity is an attractive force. So every point in the universe is pulling on every other point in the universe, albeit small, over distance. I mean, gravity, you know, falls off, you know, quite rapidly, right? So if you look at how that works with an expanding universe, we would expect to see that the universe was either slowing down, contracting, or just holding a steady state. Those are those three theories from way, 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 way back, right? However, one of the most perplexing things that was found was that the universe is actually accelerating outward. It's being pulled outward. Now, this means that something is attracting the mass from outside the boundary of our expanding universe and pulling it outward at a faster rate. Now, when I say accelerating, I don't mean it's just moving fast outward. It's actually going faster and faster outward. Now, you see, that's where we scratch our heads when we try to put this into an understanding with our standard model of astrophysics, and we can't quite do it. So we have to look at other, sometimes more exotic ways to explain it. Dark matter is matter that we only see interacting indirectly because it's, go ahead, say it, dark. Okay, but the other thing that's important is dark energy. And dark energy seems to be one of the culprits that's making our universe expand at an accelerating rate. So dark energy is certainly one of those places we have to understand. It's certainly a concept we have to understand so that we can start to harness potential, you know, gravitic drives if we are going to do that in the future. Now, how are we going to do that? We don't know yet, because the physics hasn't been written yet that can really understand and be accepted by a scientific consensus how the universe works. We don't know how that all comes together yet. So propulsive concepts. In 1994, Miguel Alcubierre came up with something called the Alcubierre drive. Now, colloquially, we call it the warp drive, right? And everyone thinks Star Trek, it's just sci-fi. Well, actually, it's not. Gene Roddenberry, although a writer, he was an avid reader. And the concept of warp-type systems didn't really exist in a fully developed manner back then, but there were hints that down the line we might be able to alter the fabric of space. And that's a term right there that, you know, people really they'll say it, but they don't really know what that means. You know, the fabric of space, the time-space continuum. Sounds like a TV show, but that's actually a physics concept, an astrophysical concept, because the universe is not just an empty place. There are interactions going on. There's forces at play. There's global forces, micro forces that are all at play, and they're all working together. And one of the things that we have yet to understand is that concert, how they all work together. And that's something that we had called, you know, GUT, you know, Grand Unified Theory in the early days, but it's really come to mean something much more. Because what happens is when you look at the universe now and as we understand it, we actually see that we know far less than we thought we did. You know, and as we try to learn ways in which we're going to create a gravitic drive, a drive that uses gravity to operate, we don't have that physics in place yet. And so we need to find ways to expand that avenue for us. Now, we don't sorry, I turned this down. I don't know if you heard that noise.
No. No. Oh,
okay, good. Then I just sounded like a fool. It's okay. So, in any case, when we look at dark energy, for instance, that is a place we need to go. And when we explore string theory and other corollaries, we're going to these theories, we're going to actually have a better handle on these things. The trouble is, there's a lot of argument, and that's why I kind of sound a little tentative right now, because I don't want to say something that's going to be expressed as a fact tomorrow when it really isn't yet a fact. But there's an awful lot of these theories that still need to be proved. Now, Michio Kaku, he is a physicist in New York who's really, well, an astrophysicist, and he actually feels that string theory is very, very important. And I have to agree with that, because I think, you know, and he doesn't need my agreement, but I do think that he has to, you know, also prove why he thinks it's important, and he tries. But the problem is that, you know, the everyday person has to understand string theory, because that way they understand why, for instance, money might be allocated to research. You know, they don't want to research, you know, what is that? I mean, this just sounds like some silly intellectual pursuit. Shouldn't we be feeding the hungry? Well, yeah, but then again, if you could find out a way to create an anti-gravity device, then guess what? Plane flights are going to cost an awful lot less, and aid flights will be so much cheaper to fly, and the concept of needing money to get someplace on Earth is going to go right down the drain. You're not going to need to worry about that anymore. So these pursuits do have a humanitarian end, you know, and you know, I don't know if you're familiar with in terms of, again, advancing our physics, so to speak, into the world of string theory and beyond, but Nikolai Kardashev came up with the type 1, type 2, and type 3 definitions for different societies. You know, a type 1 society, you're familiar with this, I think. Yeah. Some of your listeners are probably very familiar with it. Well, the type 1 society, we're about 300 years from that.
And that can leave Earth?
Well, a type 1 society knows how to use and create energy from non non-depleting sources. For instance, the sun, wave action, the wind action of the Earth, the actual dynamo in the core of the Earth itself, gravitational interaction among, you know, the Earth and Moon. So there's ways, okay, and of course, that's a type 1 society. Now, type 2 would take that a step farther, and a type 2 would then be able to harness not just all the resources, say, that the Earth had, but it would use energy on a much grander scale, and it would use...
I know right. What the thing you're saying now, that's true. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
No, that's fine.
One of the things I was just thinking of, though, can you imagine how much of a fight it would be if there was a technology breakthrough that would change the paradigm of, say, dependency on oil and things like that? I mean, you know, think of who would kill for to stop something like that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that is something we face as a species. However, there are also a tremendous number of benefits to being able to go into that arena, because if power companies were able to utilize an anti-gravity technology or be able to harness energy from the sun a thousand times, just a thousand times more efficient than they do now, efficiently, then there are plenty of opportunities and new technologies that can be spun out of that. The people that use those technologies will become the future trillionaires, you know, if they want to look at it from a business perspective. But there's a lot of things we have that are weak right now. We have an above-ground energy grid, and it's subject to weather. It's subject to solar storms. It's subject to accidental destruction. It's subject to all kinds of things. And, you know, that energy is not free. And I'm not going to go down the path of free energy, because in physics there really isn't a free energy. And I know there's a lot of devices out there that purport that, but all the ones that I've actually analyzed, because I have gotten my fair share of those as parts of cases, have been, you know, not the real thing. I'm not saying it isn't out there, but I think we need to be within the next level of physical understanding before we'll actually be able to see that. But anyway, you're right. A lot of people are going to fight for this technology, except if the energy is created by a global consortium and then made available to everybody. Well, who's to fight for it? You know, it's available to everybody. You know, and I know that that's simplifying a huge hornet's nest of politics. And that's one of the problems, though, of growing as a planet. Not growing as a country, growing as a planet. That's why when a lot of people talk about, well, maybe we'll be able to leave the Earth if we could ever stop fighting amongst ourselves. Yeah, well, that's also true. But I think that war and those kinds of squabbles, what are they over? I mean, there are religious undertones to a lot of it, but you know what? A lot of the wars are over energy, and who owns and who owns the energy. So, if an ultra superior solar panel was out there, not with an efficiency of like 42%, which some can even do now, but 95%. And of course, you say, "Well, how can that possibly be?" Well, there are ways, because as we progress, we will improve on all of the technology that we tend to create here on Earth. And as a type 1 society, we will use geothermal, we'll use sun, we'll use wave energy, and so forth. I developed Gulfstream windmills that would be so big that they would actually not even hurt a whale if it was going through it, because they're basically giant fabric vanes on the windmill that would flex with a creature and then retain their shape once they got spinning again. So, and those could generate a huge amount of torque and a huge amount of energy. I mean, little things like that. So bottom line is that there's a lot of energy sources here on Earth. The most important thing, though, is that you have to understand that every single energy generation technique that we use, except for nuclear fission, which is dangerous as all get out, is done by burning dead things. And that is something that is going to end. We're going to run out of dead things to burn. So a lot of free energy, like I said, wave action, you know what? waves go up and down all day long. I don't know, a couple of little bobbers out there that could, you know, harness the energy, and then just put 500,000 of them along the fringe of a uninhabited harbor. And, you know, you're getting free energy 24/7.
You know, the sun is the generator of all energy, as they say, with the wind and you name it and everything. But also, if there's a lot of energy stored in dead things compared to the energy you can grab that's live from, you know, the sun itself, which is but you're right. You know, eventually we'll get these things perfected more.
But you said something very important, though. There's a lot of energy stored in dead things. Right. Right now we're trying to acquire energy from the sun on Earth through a large atmosphere that's fickle at best, where much of that energy is reflected back off into space. So what we need to do is have energy-generating facilities in space. And sci-fi as that sounds, it's on the books. It's something that will happen. And the reason is because we know of the inefficiencies on Earth. Put a same solar panel up in space, and you get more efficiency because you have more direct sunlight without anything in between. Wow. So it'll be running at maximum efficiency all the time, or close to maximum efficiency. Mm-hmm. So if you take the type 1 society as one that takes a lot of energy from its sun, has no longer been burning dead things on its planet, but uses the Earth in concert with all of the resources it has that are renewable, then we're looking at something important. Fusion, I don't know if you're familiar, maybe you are. Fusion research right now commands more research dollars than every other alternative energy combined.
Wow.
And that's because they believe fusion is a coming reality. A sustainable reaction will happen. And you know what? If fusion goes amok, the reaction shuts off.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like, you know, okay, pour out that glass of water. Yeah, okay. Because you make water and you make, you know, you need tritium, okay, which is made in a breeder reactor before going through the fusion process. But this tritium is interesting because you could get near it and it won't hurt you. Most of the tritium that's in your body right now was inhaled. Wow. But it's not cumulative. It also leaves your body. So, and it can't get through your skin. So you could rub it on your skin and be perfectly safe until you sniffed your arm, you know, where you put it in, and then you have some that you ingest. But so tritium is a relatively low-level radioactive contaminant that is required as a fuel in the process. And it's easy to make, and it's something that is easy to control. And like I said, a fusion reactor, when the energy is disrupted or if electricity goes out, the reaction shuts off. Unlike a fission reactor where we know that, look at Fukushima, we know the outcome. Exactly. You know, a tsunami would shut down the plant for a while if it was fusion. In a fission reactor, it causes a potential meltdown and dead zones. So fission's not really the best, you know, not the best technology for generating energy, but we're getting there. When the fusion reactor goes online, the world's going to change. So that type of energy, when it becomes available, you see, it's a global research project like we were talking before. Fusion isn't going to be dominated by any one company because too many other people are already working on it, and they're all going to have competitive edges and competitive offers. So yes, it will be a big business for who you get your energy from. But then the time's going to come when someone's going to generate a small-scale energy generation system of some kind for your home, for your personal use. Like walking around with a pack of AA batteries in your back pocket, you will have some other type of energy system that will run everything in your house. And, you know, that way the grid can be dismantled. The grid can go away.
I think the people in, you know, in the corporate world are just going to kill everyone.
There is that distinct possibility.
Now, I want to get a little bit more back on topic because we have, you know, about 8 minutes left. So, and, you know, as I said in the beginning, we're going to talk about, you know, UFO videos and photos you analyze. But one of the things I would like, and I really do appreciate you talking about all this, and I could talk to you for hours, and we have questions coming up on the message board. that have to do with energy and stuff like that. But I would like to move on. Sorry, everyone listening to that's on the message board.
Yeah, I apologize. I sidetracked you there. But
No. I think it started.
Well, it started with talking about the automated UFO detection systems that are going to use multiple wavelengths, and then you needed me to talk about string theory, and you opened that one up.
I know, I did. I take full blame.
That's okay. It's a good blame to have.
Now, I wanted to talk about when I Googled, I was trying to look for a picture to put on our show of you, and when I Googled your name, up came the dome UFO in Jerusalem. And I wanted to talk to you about that because that is probably one of the most controversial, and if real, it was the most amazing, UFO sighting. I didn't get a chance to read the outcome of your investigation of that, but can you talk about it?
Sure. When I first received that video, I looked at it with the same excitement that I first looked at the Norway spiral that occurred, and you can look that one up down the line. But the Jerusalem Dome of the Rock UFO was really interesting to me because here we had what looked like multiple witnesses videotaping a UFO over Old Jerusalem, mm-hmm. over the Dome of the Rock. Right. Now, first of all, I don't believe that extraterrestrials would recognize the significance of our monuments. I do not. Here's what I found. There were several videos taken by purported witnesses, and one of the videos showed the UFO. Another one was sort of a zoomed-in version of that same UFO. All right. Then there were some others that were clearly fake, computer-generated, that were kind of thrown into the batch by people that just didn't know, the chronology of the case and stuff. And so I ended up, of course, having to look at those as well. And I've been misquoted all over the internet as saying that, that CG UFO proves without a doubt that, the Jerusalem UFO was fake. And that's not at all what I said. What I was really saying, the most important aspect was when you looked at the actual witness footage taken with their phones, okay, and their cameras, they were two different things. They showed two different sets of details when you looked at the details. And that's, as we all know, where the devil lives, right? The devil is in those details. And when I looked at the first one, this light came down, and then it shot up into the sky. It didn't go straight up, incidentally. It went at a slight curve, as seen from the first perspective. From the second perspective, it looked like it went straight up out of frame, but you couldn't tell its trajectory because it was zoomed in more. And then there was the flash of the ground. Based on the time of the night, there were still plenty of young people out and about, even down there where it was all taking place. But curiously, not one other report showed up other than what those couple of witnesses showed. Now, in the second video, I actually saw a UFO spinning, all right? And as it was spinning, the light was changing. Looking at us, as you could see the light changing, like it was a disc-shaped thing. It wasn't a round thing. In the previous video, it looked very different. It wasn't doing any of that. Yet it was supposed to be happening at the same time. So I felt like that was just not those data were not corroborating each other. Mm-hmm. All right. Again, I'm really hard on the data, but I'm not a debunker. I've had experiences of my own, which I cannot explain and which I attribute to potential extraterrestrial influence. I have, I saw one on a U.S. nuclear submarine in the mid-90s. I saw an unknown submerged object, and that would be for another time. I was told in no short order, I went right up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and sat with them and talked to them about it and got the same answer, that they can't tell me anything about the fast mover program. So, and that's, like I said, another thing for another time. But so when that Jerusalem UFO showed up, I looked at that and I felt that the main videos that purported to show it were just too different from each other for an event that was occurring at the same time. And then there was the flash of down below. No one reported that. Now, in this age of social media, Facebook, MySpace, okay, and all these other places, even YouTube commentary, all right, you would expect someone would have said, yeah, I saw it too. Oh, yeah, I saw it too, and here's my video. Okay, when I saw this thing hovering over there, I took a video too. Not any of it. And then later on, So I pronounced it as I believed at the time. I said, you know what, as much as we'd like to believe it, and you know, unless I'm not seeing something, I have to call this a hoax. It looks to me like a computer-generated hoax because I do all the things in my company that I own. I do all those kinds of computer graphics things that I'm seeing here. And I can generate this hoax. I can create this too. So, you know, that doesn't mean it's a hoax for sure, but I'm saying that it's well within capability and it's real easy in this particular case because you get it. It's night, it's a point of light, you know. It's very easy to create that. It's much harder to create something during the day flying through city streets, for instance. Well, in any case, later on, it was like, I don't know, a few weeks later, an Israeli reporter got a hold of the story. And he started looking into it, and he discovered that the two or three main witnesses to the event were all part of the same film class.
Yes. Yes, I remember that. Hey, Mark, we only have about a minute and a half here. I'm going to ask you a question here. Now, would you mind hanging out with me after the live show? And we'll talk a little bit more, so we'll put this on the podcast. We'll record on the podcast for the listener. Can you tell, is there any place that someone can actually find you on the internet, or you actually don't have a website up or anything like that?
Well, actually, my business is a special effects and model making business, and it's called FX Models, as in Foxtrot X-Ray Models, M-O-D-E-L-S, .com. And I don't have anything about UFOs up there right now, because that's just my day-to-day business website. But, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we are working on these UFO detection systems, and we're going to be coming out with much more information about those soon.
Okay,
I'm
sorry to cut you short, but
no.
So that's it for our live show, and we're coming right back for the extended version. So this is our extended version, our first extended version past the live show. And so, Mark, I'm sorry I had to cut you short, and
no,
we can keep talking. So basically, what was the outcome of the – do you think it – because the students got together, they did this as a hoax?
I think that the way the investigative reporter in Israel phrased it, it was sort of a production project that was supposed to be part of a viral ad campaign. And so they were using their techniques they learned in their classes to create a generated hoax. But that all said, again, you know, my mind is not closed. If there's other data that has not been seen, or even if there are other agencies or groups out there that put out a lot of disinformation of some kind and said, well, hey, you know, let's just say it was a hoax so that they don't find out the truth. Well, see, I try not to fall victim to that. I just look at the data. Data is not opinionated. The data simply stands on its own. And when I looked at the Jerusalem UFO data, the different video imagery, they looked different to me. It didn't look like it was the same object. There were more details in one than in the other, when in the other you should have seen them too. So I don't, I just don't get it. And then the flash and the lack of any social media uproar. The Dome of the Rock, one of history's most important locations, has this UFO over it, and this giant flash illuminates old Jerusalem, and no one but two people see it? Right there. That. You don't need to be a photo and video analyst to know that something's wrong with that picture.
Well, I think, you know, they really picked out too big of a monumental, monument to do this from. Like you say, there's always thousands of people around that thing at all times.
Yes, there are. All night long.
I was going to say all night long, 24 hours.
No, there are curfews. In Israel, there are curfews. And that was something I was working with, too, was to understand, what was the curfew? Okay, because they were out, and it wasn't illegal for them to be within missile range, shoulder-mounted missile range of the Dome of the Rock. So clearly, other people had to have been able to be out and be closer. So they would have seen it. Plus, up on that ridge, you didn't just hear the two of them talking or the three of them talking. You heard all kinds of people talking, going, ooh, ah, and not one further report from any of those other ancillary people. So, you see, these are the factoids that you have to consider. You cannot let it sit. You've got to consider that information.
You know, I talked to Dr. Bruce McAbee about, you know, situations of, you know, analyzing photos and videos. And the first thing he said is, you know, that it's all secondary. The first thing is the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you basically agree with that?
Well, I mean, Bruce and I are friends. He's a great guy. And what I do is when I actually do an analysis, I do not look at the witness report until I do my analysis, because I don't want to be influenced by what I'm seeing, you know, or what I've read. I'll tell you why. I did four cases tonight, just tonight.
Really?
Yeah. And in one of them, I was dead set on, you know, not wanting to know anything about the sighting. And what it was a bright little tiny bit of light, you know, in a shot taken looking directly at the sun, which I always say to people, don't do that and then submit Planet X to me, okay? I'm not going to go down that path. You can't see a planet next to the sun in full bright light of day and take a picture of it with your cell phone. You can do that with a telescope. When you isolate the field of the sky and you see a tiny little dot of Venus, you can actually see Venus during the day, all right, if you know where to look. And I can even see it with my eyes if I know where to look. And you got to stare at it for a while and let all the floaters in your eye get out of the way. I'm not kidding, all right? But it is a rite of passage to find Venus during the day. But try taking a picture of that with your cell phone. You're just not going to get it, all right? So what most people see is these large light, you know, lens flares and specular reflections off of dust that's on the lens cover and more likely the filter that's over the lens. And so you know, those types of things are not UFOs, you know. But one of the things that we have to look at is that the witness testimony sometimes relays something extraordinary, but the data doesn't support it. So I can't say, like the cases tonight, I said, well, the witness says that this thing came out, it shot around at extremely high speed, was flying around at this unbelievable speed, went back and forth, you know, toward the sun and back. But he submitted a photo looking right at the sun, showing a gigantic lens flare. But in addition, he saw, or he also recorded this little tiny white dot that was in there. And it wasn't even a dot. It was sort of a smudge, way, way off in the distance, you know. And I was asked to corroborate what the witness was saying. And I couldn't. I said, well, we can't. The data certainly doesn't support this rapidly flying thing. However, if he was looking at the sun with his camera, because it was a Samsung phone that he used to take the picture, and he was moving it around, guess what? That lens flare and any other object that's a result of the sun is going to dance all over the sky, you know, apparently on that camera screen. And it was a big tablet-sized screen. So I'm sure that, you know, there was plenty to see. It was a really good camera, you know, on this phone. So, you know, the data doesn't corroborate what he saw. Or claims to have seen. So I couldn't call it what he said. I couldn't say it was what he said. But I could say that this looks similar to a specular reflection of dust on a lens, and that's obviously a giant lens flare. This we know from physics. So I'm sorry. Your data doesn't corroborate. You may have seen something really cool, but I can't verify it with this one picture.
Right. Now, earlier we had on our message board someone wanted to ask you what you thought about rods.
Oh, rods, yeah. I have analyzed rod footage quite a bit. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about them is that they look like these strange creatures that are traveling along with these little gossamer spirally wings. But you can go out and find them yourself. You can create them right away. All you have to do is find insects flying through the video frame, all right? And then at the frame rate of the video frame, and depending on where the sunlight is, you can actually generate that little sine wave look, in your images. In fact, I reference that quite a bit when I'm looking at some images. I can deduce by how many peaks of that curve are visible in an exposure of a certain amount of time. Say it was a 30th of a second, right? And you see four peaks in that curve, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's four peaks in a 30th of a second, all right? So that means you're going to get roughly 12 peaks per second times 60 seconds, okay, gives you, you know, over 600 and change wing beats per minute. And now, based on the wing beats per minute that this photo captured, you can go look at the location they're at and actually come up with a reasonable guess as to what that actually was and what insect it was. Because some of them have extraordinary wing beat frequencies, and some, you know, some are high, some are extremely low.
Are you talking like the Denver video?
Oh, yeah, like in the Denver video where you actually see, I think that's the one, right, where you actually see objects flying through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when I analyzed that one up close and I took still frames, you can actually see the body. If it's the same one we're talking about, it was the body of an insect that was elongated slightly because the footage wasn't taken at 120 frames per second or 60 frames per second. It was like at 30 frames per second. Mm. So effectively, each still frame is a 30th of a second photograph. That's why they're always fuzzy.
Right.
All right. At 120 frames per second, you have a photo that's very sharp, relatively. And at a 60th of a second, that's pretty much the minimum for getting a sharp still frame, as long as the camera's not moving a whole lot. Now, in the film work I do, we've actually done frame rates of 1,600 frames per second. It was one Burger King commercial that I worked on with Doug. And we actually had this special camera called the Phantom, which was taking images of a 2,500 RPM giant Oreo cookie spinning around, and it was spewing out liquid nitrogen because that's – I created this thing, you know, to make this – and we
I
put
think
a –
you have too much time in your hands.
Oh, no, this was a great job. I loved it, you know, and this is the kind of thing – this is why I love working with Doug Trumbull, because he's just – it's so cool. We do organic effects. So this spinning cookie – and there's a point to this. The spinning cookie, you literally saw this brown blur. Now, it was 10 inches in diameter, by the way. It was an oversized Oreo, so a lot of people really wanted an Oreo cake, you know, when we were done, but there was none to be found. So this spinning cookie had liquid nitrogen coming out of the edges, and the entire take – all right, was done in a second and a half. So I would run the liquid nitrogen down through the rig. The cookie would spin up 2,500 frames per or 2,500 RPM. It was a brown blur with a white center, okay, and all this liquid nitrogen coming out of the white center. And so you had all this steam and a fan blowing it back like a comet. And the whole exposure, the whole shot was, okay, cut. Hey, that was great.
Wow.
All right, yeah, now. But play it back now, all right? It was a 1,600 frame per second take. So when you play it back at normal frame rates, you've got this beautiful, slow, graceful, massive cookie coursing through space, spewing cometary debris and clouds of dust and steam blowing back behind it. It looked gorgeous, all right? So you see, this is why I can see the world in different ways because I look at the world this way. I see the world at fast and slow rates, right? So when I see an insect on film, I see a sine wave of a wing beat pattern that was caught based on the length of the exposure, see?
Wow.
And that's where this all comes from. This is stuff I've been doing since I was a kid, you know? Again, you heard me, and I'm not lying. 1971, I joined at age 11, and it was then when I started looking into the science of what makes those things tick that people see out there. And of course, that meant I had to explore the natural world like crazy in order to understand the laws, the natural laws, physical laws, the laws throughout science. I went to school for science. I was a science geek and a nerd throughout college. Other people are playing football. I'm in the basement of the science library studying physics. Mm-hmm. What the heck is wrong with me?
Well, you've led an interesting life, I'm sure, because of that. One of the questions that came up on the message board was, what was your most interesting analysis? And I'm going to add to that, have you ever seen anything that you were totally convinced is possibly extraterrestrial or just plain unexplainable.
Yeah, absolutely. But it wasn't the UFO. It was actually a close encounter.
Really?
Yeah. And this is why, you know, when people they like to call me a debunker, but they got to understand, these people, they don't have a clue. I am not a debunker. I actually not only believe, okay, I do talks around the country explaining the science of why they certainly can be here. I don't walk around and saying they're not here. I walk around saying I think they are, and here's why. So that's really the way that I work. But I am hard on data, and one of the things that happened to me, two things. The first was seeing the fast mover on the nuclear sub. Now, it was in the middle of the 90s. I was a guest because to this day I still do a lot of work for the Navy, and I end up – sometimes they'll say, hey, do you want to go check out an aircraft carrier? Or, hey, how about a ride in a submarine? You know, I know that sounds kind of flippant, but believe me, they're very sparing, and they are – you know, they're only after doing something that's, you know, really above and beyond. So I try to do that from time to time. So I did go on board a U.S. sub. It was the most fun I had getting seasick. No, don't lie. And, you know, I while hanging on the sky periscope half the time, just so I could just see a horizon, you know, there's no windows in these things, you know. I then went into the sonar shack. They call it the sonar shack. It's a little alleyway along the control room in the submarine. And that's where all the sonar guys sit, and they look at the screens, and they look like in the Matrix. Remember the green letters going down the screen?
Yes.
Okay, well, now take those and dissolve them from being letters into static. Hmm. And that's what a sonar display on a submarine looks like, you know, on a Los Angeles class sub that I was on at the time. Well, but within that data, you actually see hard lines and other types of information and curving lines that change over time. The refresh rate is much slower, can be much slower than you see in the Matrix, that kind of thing. But that's exactly what it looks like, okay? Now, take this and imagine. When a sonar guy looks at that screen, he knows exactly what he's looking at most of the time. Mm-hmm. They have biologics, which are whales and schools of fish. Some animals in the sea make popping noises and those show up. The submarine listens, to find out where it's going. It listens to the surroundings to know where it's going. You know, it can't see ahead. You know what I mean? It has to listen ahead. So accurate charts and sonar are how a submarine moves around in the ocean for the most part. So imagine now I'm sitting there watching the sonar display. The reason I'm in there is because it's a seat. It's out of the way of the mainstream. You know, you got 130 guys on board a sub or more, and walking down a hallway is especially at the height of a shift is crazy because it's the hallways 30 inches wide. And to get by someone, especially this 6-foot submariner, I don't know why he would get on a submarine at 6 feet tall. But you have to turn your body sideways to let him squeeze by, and then you keep going. And so the quiet was what I was looking for some of the time when I was on board. So I would sit in the sonar shack. It's dark, and all you see is this green screen going down, green, green, green. And so I was like, this is nice. And I had learned how to read sonar a little bit before I went on board because I was really interested in the technology. And I actually had a simulator that showed me how to read Los Angeles class submarine sonar. So I was looking, and by getting into something, it took my mind off the fact that I was feeling like I was going to get sick. So I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, amidst all the other lines that are showing up on there, which is like a distant ship, that's a tanker, that one has, that one's a single screw, four-bladed propeller, and this tanker that's, 12 miles away. I mean, that's the kind of resolution, they can get in beyond that nowadays. Well, anyway, as I'm sitting there, all of a sudden on the screen, you see this line appear and just go through the field. And it was moving, I can't discuss the actual shape and so forth because that, gives away some of the sonar stuff. But I can tell you this. We saw something on that sonar that executed a path that was not like anything known. And the first thing that the sonar – I call him a kid. The sonar kid did, was he corroborated it with another sonar, all right, that wasn't you know, working with this sonar. It was a separate system just for that purpose. In other words, if there's a torpedo coming at you, you really want to make sure you're not going to fire unless you can corroborate that the sonar's not acting up or doing something.
Right.
So anyway, and that's sort of a simplification because sonar systems are really, really good and you don't need a whole lot of double coverage. But that all said, in this particular case, he looked at a second one and confirmed it was there too. Different shape, different look, but it was there. So he immediately calls the XO, the executive officer. He says, "Con sonar, fast mover." I was like, "Oh my God, I'm in a science fiction movie. Holy crap." I mean, no lie. I suddenly just, if I was sick, I had forgotten all about it. The executive officer, I could hear him coming, and he comes right around into this little sonar alley, followed by a couple of other people. And he looks at the screen. "What do you got?" And he shows him. Okay. And as the other guys came in, they kind of crowded around the screen and kind of – I backed away because it's not my boat. Right? And I let them do their thing. But I overheard very clearly and very precisely, I heard the kid say that it was moving at several hundred knots.
Wow.
And he said – and then the XO looked at it. Did some fiddling and checked out different ranges and stuff on the screen.
Now, were you talking above water or below water?
No, this was below water.
That's what I thought you meant.
My goodness. And so he, you know, the kid at the sonar said disposition. And he looked at the XO, and the XO just looked at him for a second. You know, and again, I try to be very precise when I retell this because you know how what happens over time, people kind of add and embellish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, all that I know and only what I know. I don't – there's nothing to add. Okay, so I'm just telling you exactly what it was. The XO just looked at the kid and he said, "Log it and dog it."
Wow. Now, what was that – I guess you'd call it a USO. What was the range? How far away was it from your sub actually?
Don't know. I don't know that. Actually, in if I did, I probably I probably forgot it over time. So I don't know. Because I couldn't remember what the range was. Because what happened was when it first happened, he was flicking back and forth. And you can flick back and forth all these different range settings anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really tell. You know, most people think of a radar screen when they think of sonar. That's not what this is. It's a square screen, you know, and stuff moves from top to bottom. You know, if you look up Los Angeles class submarine sonar online, you'll actually find, you know, some really good examples. Just don't go to the Hollywood movies. They turn them into, you know, air traffic controller type screens. It's just ridiculous. It's not the reality. Mm-hmm. So that all said, you know, later on I walked up to the XO, still very excited. I was actually kind of breathless when I saw this because I couldn't use – you know, there was no one I could talk to, you know. And back then, I think I had, I don't even know if I had a cell phone back then. Holy cow. In the mid-90s, I must have had, must have been, yeah, it was probably, I think it was this older one where, you know, every minute was 25 cents or 18 cents. I forget what it was. If it existed at all, I don't even remember back then. But I went up to the executive officer. And I said, "XO, I'm very familiar with fast movers. You know, can you tell me anything about this?" And he looked at me, and he said, "Mr. D'Antonio, are you enjoying this your cruise?" I said, "Absolutely, sir." And he put his hand on my shoulder and smiled, and he said, "Let's keep it that way."
Wow.
And I was like, "Wow. Yes, sir." And I, you know what? I said, "Yes, sir."
So do you think this is a common occurrence?
Well, I didn't know. And there, it's interesting. It's almost as if I told you this before, but I don't think I did. You know, what happened was later on in the wardroom when we're eating dinner, because one of the things is, you know, when you're a guest, you know, they do nice things for you. So it was our turn to sit in the wardroom with the captain and, you know, have dinner with them. It was nice. And you know, this is why the submarine Navy, people want to be in the submarine Navy. Yeah, there's no windows, but you know what? The food is the best in all the services.
And it's actually – weight.
It's always been true. It really is. You know, and the cook can make or break a crew. So they really, really, really train excessively. You can't imagine. So anyway, while sitting there, I look at the XO and I get that little smile on my face. Okay. Like I want to ask him, mm-hmm. you know, and I kind of scratch my nose and I look down and I, you know, that little smirk like, well, are you going to share something? And he's across the table diagonally. Okay. It's at one side of the captain. I can't remember where. But there's an order of things, I guess. Well, anyway, he looks at me and he goes, he just sort of points at me and he says, "Still having a good time?" And I went, yes, sir. And he smiles and goes, mm-hmm. And he turns away. So, you know, so he was just trying to remind me. And that never, and it never came up again until about, and that was the mid-90s. It didn't come up again until about 5 years ago when I did a job for the Joint Chiefs down in D.C. And I became friends with one of them. And I had done a project for him, and I talked to him on the phone. And he said, "Well, you're gonna be down here this way?" I said, "Yeah, I think I could. In fact, you know, I'm up for a drive. I mean, Washington's only 6 hours away." I literally do that in one day. I do. I drive down and back to Washington D.C. in one day. I have no problem with it because, you know, I'm just focused. I do my thing and I come home. And then I sit there scratching my head in my office saying, did I really see the Washington Monument today? you know? Well, anyway, so I went down there and I drove down there with my 9-year-old son at the time. He's now 16. So it wasn't 5 years ago, right? It was 7 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. While he was in the – we went to this particular the home of this guy. And it was just me and him, his wife, and my son. And while he was – my wife – no, my wife. His wife and my son were actually in the kitchen making lemonade. I leaned over and I said to the chief, I said, what can you tell me about the Fast Mover program? Hmm. And he just sat back in his couch, you know, and we both had like lemonades or whatever it was we were drinking, you know. And there was this really uncomfortable silence for about 15 seconds. And he's kind of looking around and he kind of, you know, looks at me. I can't remember exactly all the things that he did. He had some gestures, which led me to believe he knew something. But then he said the one sentence. He looked at me and he just sort of shrugged a little and he said, I'm sorry, Mark. I can't tell you anything about the program. Wow. And it was that knowing smile look. Mm-hmm. It's not the oh, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about the program. He didn't say that. He said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you anything about the program.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I said, you know, Admiral, fair enough, cheers. And we kind of clinked there. You know, I remember it was iced tea, I guess. I don't remember. You know, it's a long time ago. Well, anyway, you know, so that's as much as I remember about that. You know, a lot more happened that day with him, but I can't remember well enough to really commit it and say this is exactly what happened, but nothing UFO related, just you know, event wise being there. But we spent the whole afternoon at his house, and then when we left, he was kind enough to give my son one of his battle coins, which is a prize. It's a prize possession, and he actually gave him two, which is really cool. They hit it off like you can't believe, like grandfather and grandson, you know. Mm. At one point, I was with his wife in the couch in the living room, and he disappeared with my son into another room to show him his train collection.
Oh, wow.
yeah, it was really funny. Yeah. So it was great. It was a really good day. It was a good time, you know. But I did get – you know, I was all the way home. All I could think about was, wow, I can't tell you anything about that. I can't tell you anything. That means he knows. No, he said, and the way he looked, and by the time I got home, I had almost forgotten the look on his face about how he, the way he looked at me when he said that sentence, because that said everything to me. In that moment, it said everything to me. And now when I relay the story, I don't remember that visceral feeling I had when he said that. I know that I was certainly excited, but I can't remember that visceral feeling of knowing, oh my gosh, this is real. Yeah. You know, I can't reproduce that in my gut, and I'm really sorry about that, you know, because I want to. I want to feel that again, you know, about what that felt like to know that this guy knew.
Right, right.
Yeah.
We're just about out of time to make this an hour and a half show. And thanks for the listener to listen in for this extended version. I wanted to ask you to basically wrap it up. What would you say has been the latest, most compelling either video or images that you've been involved in lately?
Well, one of the things that you know, I did do was I did a number of episodes of NASA's Unexplained Files, and that's a show which you know, you like it or hate it, you know, it actually does produce something cool. And one of the things we did was to use science to explain a lot of different things, including how aliens could be here, you know, the real thing. So I know you're talking about a UFO thing, and I do have something I can say to that in a minute. But so we did that, and then the other thing I did was a television show on artificial structures on the moon. And I can't give away any data other than to tell you that some of the images stumped me. Hmm. And I don't believe they were artificially created. I believe not the structures. I don't believe that the images were faked is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. When I looked at these, I was stunned. So that's, to me, very interesting. Okay, so I looked at that and I was like, wow. You know, because that does strike a visceral chord in me, because to me, if I were an alien race of beings, certainly a tiny, tiny minority, maybe just a handful, coming to a planet with billions of inhabitants, I would probably set up shop far enough away that I knew they couldn't get to me, and then just kind of reach out and get to them. Because with some of the futuristic propulsion, we might be able to get to Mars in just a few minutes. So going from the moon to the Earth would, you know, take, you know, no time at all for people with that kind of advancement. So I'd set up shop on the moon.
Did these, pardon me for interrupting, did these images come from the orbiter, or where did they come from?
Well, that'll be made clear in the show. I signed a document saying I can't talk about it. Mm-hmm. But I, gosh, I really want to. But
I promise I'll edit it out if you tell.
Oh, no.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I know. Okay. No, but the thing is, even in person, I would respect the agreement, right? But I'll tell you this. These objects were in data that was acquired during the Apollo years and with modern orbiters that were circling the moon. And the thing that got me was when I would look at an old Apollo image and see something, you know, from lunar orbit and say, okay, well, I want that same frame using, you know, LRO or Clementine or something like that, and then see it again. That was what I found to be very compelling. So right here at home, our own moon, for crying out loud, there might be something going on there. Who knows? I'm not a big, you know, lunar anomaly guy. In fact, I think most are, you know, they say tricks of light and shadow. But one of the things that I did was I created a way to actually demonstrate live how those things actually occur by literally creating. Again, I'm a special effects guy, right? With mm-hmm. you know, with the film arena. So I actually created a lunar surface that we could pelt with meteorites and other things to generate actual landforms dynamically, right, live on camera. So that display, that thing. In fact, I used to take this thing around. I would actually take this around the country to actually show people. I've done this before. And you use different materials. Well, anyway, it's really neat, but you know, we'll see how much gets into the show. I know that, again, I can't say anything more about it, and I won't, but I do know that there are one or two images that I was shown that I simply couldn't explain and that I found corroborative data for, you know, from what they provided. So I was like, wow.
That's do you know neat. When that was going to air?
I don't. In fact, I sent an email today to the producer asking, you know, what's going on? Because I want them to come back and you know, film some more of the things they were talking about that we were talking about doing. So really cool.
That is great. No? Hey, well, you know what? It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I feel like we haven't finished, like we can talk again sometime soon.
Absolutely. We can talk about, in fact, when, you know, we stayed specifically away from all the background and details of the UFO detection systems. I mean, that's going to be a multi-instrument Skywatch system deployed all over the Southwest and America and in the ocean. I've got some set up for USOs that I designed one for USO hunting and, you know, one for UFO hunting on land. And we have a science team from all over the country of people much smarter than me that are working with me to try early on. And now we're actually making it smaller, portable, reproducible, and we're going to have it talk to satellites to send us data. And that part already works.
Wow.
So we're making progress. It's pretty cool.
Well, that's great. So thank you so much, Mark. It's been a real
of course,
pleasure.
Martin. Thank you so much for having me. I'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guests, of course, Mark D'Antonio, Keith Rowland, the producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network,
Andy Fleming for the Astronomy News, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page, and remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live next week with the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room at Podcast UFO. This is Martin Willis telling you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you next week.